Interview with Mrs. Violet Dunbar Eagles on May 19, 1988. Interviewer, Ann Carroll. Mrs. Eagles begins the tape by talking about her husband, Dean Blythe Eagles.
He's writing, you see. Well, then the Depression came, and so this was partly paid for by Empire Marketing Board and the university, see. He wasn't doing any teaching, I don't think. Then when the Depression came and the university grants were cut, you know some of the 30s, but you won't feel it the way we do. then he worked. Well, he really didn't have a job, and he worked for the Powell River. They were having trouble with their paper, Darkney, and so he worked with the Powell River people. As a matter of fact, he was up there all in winter, and I stayed down here trying to solve their darkening of the paper. And then Professor Sadler, well, I suppose this is part of the faculty movement. So Professor Sadler, who was head of Derry, in 29, when we came back there, they had quite a little department. There's Professor Sadler and Dr. Golding and two or three girls, 29, Thelma College, who married, is still living, Thelma, who married Bill Ingalls, one of the shoe people. And Thelma had majored in bacteriology, so she was an assistant in the dairy lab. University, and that all went, the whole department went, just slash like that, you see. Golding got another job, and Blythe went to work for the Powell River part-time, and one winter he was up there all winter. So then they said to him, okay, you can have the job in dairying, except that you don't know anything about dairying. So if you go your summer and learn some dairying, we'll give you an appointment in dairying. So we took off, and now Professor Sadler wasn't very well. And he was quite a character. He was an Englishman, and they made tea in the lab every morning. It had to be poured through an Erlenmeyer flask of cotton wool in it, and poured just so and so and so. But anyway, he wasn't very well, so he went on a boat trip. We were the last ones that saw him off here at Westminster. He was going. I don't know how long he's going to be away. And on a freighter, they just took 12 people. Well, he was drowned at sea. Nobody knows he got dizzy or what happened.
How terrible.
So they didn't have any children. He married Olive McLean, who's a bacteriologist. So they said, if you take the summer off at your own expense. Salaries had, my husband came at $3,600, and then it was cut to $1,800 when they budget, you know, when they slashed the Hinchcliffe, that was his name, I think, the Minister of Education. They wanted to cut the university out entirely, I've forgotten who all went to bat, and anyway, they persuaded them to, but it was cut. So you had to go to your own expense. So we took a car and drove to California, visiting an uncle of mine, then drove all across the South. And in those days, you couldn't buy special clothes for the hot climate, you know. And we had awful outfits. And we went to New Orleans, and I looked in at a cousin of mine, about a third cousin, I think, just to say hello from my mother. And they said, oh, you must come and stay overnight anyway, you see. And here we were in these awful clothes. And the husband, he was chairman of the port of New Orleans in his Palm Beach suit, you know. They once came up later to Vancouver, and we took the faculty club so that they would realize we weren't quite the poor relatives. That they were very nice about it, but I'm sure they must have been embarrassed. So anyway, then we got to Washington, and we spent, I think it was 2 months, my husband working in the Department of Dairying in Washington.
In Washington, D.C.?
Yeah. Oh. We had a little apartment, and you couldn't find apartments. That was just when Roosevelt and the New Deal had come in. And if you went someplace, they'd say, well, give us your name, maybe in a month, so on. So we just had rooms in a house, no air conditioning, which was very hot.
Oh, it can be terrible in August, in the summer, can't it?
Once, and we would put up lunch and go to a park. But I remember one day we went with some nice grass, and we went walking, and I woke up in the night, my legs all scratching. And my husband went to the lab the next morning and said, I don't know where she got. And they said, they just howls, and they said, chiggers. These little microscopic things that any local person would know not to walk in the grass, you see.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
And they just get under the skin. It doesn't last that long. So we spent 2 months, then we went up to Ontario. We spent a week with dairy people around Montreal. And then we went to Ontario and London. And I had an aunt there, which I stayed with. And he would go out. These contacts had been made ahead of time. And he would go out with the dairyman, visiting cheese factory. Mm-hmm. All over Ontario. So we spent the summer, and then we drove home. And those days, it was pretty good not to have punctures, and we were very pleased that we had gone 15,000 miles without a puncture. So
that's a very long trip. That was a long trip at that time.
Oh, it was.
It?
Well, you motored all across the United States, and up to Canada, and so on. So that, 34, so the day when we came back, then I guess I started to go in the Faculty Women's Club. I remember going to Mrs. Shrum's, and Mrs. Coleman's. Coleman was president. Mm-hmm. And we always met in houses then. And I've forgotten Mrs. Lemmy Robertson, went to her place. And so then in 39, the Brock was built.
Thanks partly to the help from the Faculty Women's Club, too, I gather.
No, not in building it. No.
But for furnishing
of
the rooms?
Oh, yes. So we had a big tea, and to raise money, go on with this furnishing. The Faculty Women's Club, way back 1919-1920, and in there somewhere, had raised money, and had raised $1,200 towards getting a club room of their own, and they had this furnishing fund, you see. That was a lot of money. So we had this big tea, and to raise more money, because they were going to give us, now the Dean Brock had been killed before this, wasn't he? Yes. One room that they were giving us, they had called it the Mildred Brock room, and that was to be our room. So it was at $1,200, a little bit of money that we made there. we furnished that room. I don't know how many Chesterfields there were. Because it was quite well furnished, Greek. You know, the room?
I don't know it, no.
I wonder what it is now. And of course you know about two Emily Carr pictures.
Yes. And now, who donated or bought those for the Faculty Women's Club?
Okay. There were two paintings hanging there, one on either end. Now, way back in the late 20s, a group was formed, partly wives of UBC professors. No, some of them were Queen's graduates. They weren't all. And it was a study group. And they met every 2 weeks and they worked hard. I don't know who all belonged to it. I was asked to join in the late 40s. This was when they formed that club. The Mildred Brock room with the two pictures. They were hanging there, and they just hung there. It was quite a while. Some years and years later, when I ran into, I don't know who it was, said, we no longer met there, that was where. One of the deans, and I'd have to think who it was, said to him, you know, I heard by the grapevine that the students think those pictures belong to them because they're in the Brock building. And she said, who do they belong to? So, I don't know. At that time, I had been asked to join this group, you see. So I said, well, I don't know. I'll ask any of the old timers about these pictures. And now Mrs. McLeod, Hector McLeod's wife, mm-hmm. who was a lovely person, and she joined in the early 40s. And soon after all this about, she may have belonged when the pictures came there. And she said, I don't know. She said, the Monday Art Group asked permission, they came to the they had these two pictures. Oh yes, Nan Cheney was very anxious. She was supporting and she said to the Monday Art Group, do you think we could spend $50 each for these, Ed? The group said, oh, no, no, but she persisted. And finally they gave in. And so they paid $50 each for them.
And it was Nan Cheney encouraged them to buy them.
Yeah. So as far as anybody knows, they just went up and hung them up, that's all. They was never presented. They were never given to the Faculty Women's Club. They have searched their minutes. I phoned Beth Klink, who was secretary of the Board of Governors with her. She's still living, you know. Mm-hmm. I had one of these minute minds. And I said, do you ever recall anything in the minutes of the board? These things had been given to the university. No. And I said to Mrs. McLeod, who were they given to? She said, I don't think they were ever given to anybody. She said, now, if there's ever any trouble with them, I would go and testify that they were meant for the university. But at the time, they were just asked permission. I don't know where they went to the Faculty Women's Club and said, can we hang them up? Nobody seemed to know. We couldn't find anybody. Mrs. McLeod said they had a tea. They hung them up at night, and they had a tea there. And the Brocks were there, David Brock and so on the next day to sort of, but there was nothing, there was no official ceremony that we're giving them. Mm-hmm. So nobody knew who they belonged to. But anyway, I'd have to think who was dean at the time. Anyway, they managed to get them out of there without any fuss.
Was it the dean of women? Was it Dean McCrae?
I think it was. I think it was Dean McCrae. Helen McCrae. I think it was Helen McCrae. Yeah, when you come to think of it, it was. I ran into her somewhere, I've forgotten, and she just heard this by the grapevine that the students had said, now look, this is our building, and so on. And and so anyway, they spirited them away, and with the students raising no row about it. And I understand they're in the dean's office. I don't know where they are now, but for a while they were in the dean's office, you know.
Was Dean McCrae, was she closely tied with the Faculty Women's Club? Did she come and suggest areas where the Faculty Women's Club could help, or did the Faculty Women's Club just decide on its own that they wanted to support the students or help with furnishings of dorms, or how did that work? Did she suggest where there might be help needed, or was it the members themselves that decided?
I don't know that. I'd have to think about that. I think once a year. There was a student. See, the Mildred Brock scholarship went way back.
Yes.
They established that in the early days.
Or the Ann Westbrook?
Ann Westbrook.
Yeah.
The Ann Westbrook. And now, getting residences, that had gone long, long before I ever came to look in the picture. So that wasn't a...
but I gather furnishing the army huts was quite a concern for the Faculty Women's Club, or maybe that's not right.
I don't know. I don't. My mind. No, if we did it. It isn't. It certainly isn't anything that I was involved in. Mm-hmm. We did have a committee, and now it was during that time that we started to bursaries. You see, mm-hmm. there'd only been the Mildred Brock scholarship, and then they started. Bursaries, which we worked through the Dean of Women's Office, you see. Yeah. And the person who won the Ann Westbrook, now I don't know whether we used to have her come to a meeting or not, I wouldn't be sure of that. No, if we did anything with the huts, it wasn't anything I was involved in. So I have no recollection of it.
What were the areas that you were involved in the Faculty Women's Club?
Well, see, when the war started, most of the 29, not in 39, I suppose, when people really got busy, you know. The Faculty Women's Club, the students had to do war work. Mm-hmm. And some of them belonged to the Air Force outfit and so on. But then the people that didn't do that, through the Red Cross, this is probably what you get again. The Faculty Women's Club were asked to look after the Red Cross end of what the students did. Mm-hmm. So in the top floor of the Brock, one was in one corner, and down. One was knitting and one was sewing. Mm-hmm. And the girls came in. They had to get 1 hour a week.
These are the students?
The students.
Oh.
And Kay Sauer, to start with, was Kay liked to sew, and I liked to sew. And when the Sauers were moved to Ottawa, he is a historian. Mm-hmm. Then Lillian Muir, do you know Lillian at all?
I know the name, yes.
Well, Lillian took over. Now, I came in from Burnaby 2 days a week, see? And I worked in sewing. Mm-hmm. And now the knitting people were down. Now, Mrs. McLeod, Hector's wife, was in knitting. Laura Drummond, I don't know who all worked in knitting. No, I wouldn't know. I know Laura Drummond was very active down in and the girls came in once a week. We cut out stuff. The director, and the girls just came in. Now, the Red Cross were very naive, you know. We made pajamas, but that was all right. We made boys' pants. Give us a bullet. No directions. And that was before the days of zippers. And you we had a machine for making buttonholes. And you put buttonholes. And I don't know whether you knew old Ben, how you know how yeah. men's pants were, you see. And we'd make these buttonholes. And you put that inside. Well, we put it in like we do a thing on a woman's skirt. And it was messy. Just plain messy. And come with the Red Cross, no directions, you see. And it dawned on me one night in bed how you did this. I remember lying there how we did it. That you sewed this up and the belt all in one fell swoop. You didn't put it on like we did.
Right.
So that's all that one. We had children's coats. Inset pockets of all things.
Oh my goodness.
They were messy. None of us knew how to do it. Why they ever would give you, mind you, it's hard to make a good outside pocket. Mm-hmm. But when you were sending them for warmth, it didn't matter that much how good it was.
No.
But to give you a pattern with the inside. No.
Excuse me, would you like coffee?
Oh, you'd like a cup of coffee, wouldn't you?
Sure,
anything?
Thank you.
These inset pockets, and to this day, you can't buy a pattern. Well, unless Vogue have changed recently, you can't buy a pattern, and follow directions, and make a good inset pocket. You've got to be taught how to make it. You know.
Yes.
The directions are just what you do for cotton, and if you do that, they're just messy. Well, they were messy. I later went to there used to be a thing in Vancouver called the Academy of Useful Arts. And I went and took a 6-month course. I got a certificate in tailoring for somewhere.
Terrific.
I got so exasperated. I didn't go 6 months, but that's what it was supposed to be. I can make a good buttonhole now. But unless you're taught, you just can't do that sort of thing.
No.
So that went on. So the Faculty Women's Club didn't do much outside.
I saw that you sent parcels to the sons of faculty members who were overseas.
Well, if we did, I don't remember this. Yeah. So, you see, that probably...
It's probably a small part of what you did.
You get some of that for minutes, I guess. I can remember the secretary reading off names of... we want that left there, Jimmy, so... There's some serviettes here, Jeannie.
Oh. I saw you got in your papers that you donated to the archives, there was a certificate from the Department of Civil Defense.
I didn't know I donated any. That must have been amongst Blythe.
Yes.
I didn't know they'd taken
it. It was a certificate for you from the Department of Civil Defense.
Oh, my.
And I wondered what you'd done to get that certificate. Was that part of
work
for the Red Cross?
Did you want cream?
I got some.
Oh, dear, I don't know. No, I don't actually know. Because I did 2 days at the university. I suspect it was through the university, although I wouldn't swear to it. That we sold here at home, local people all the time, under Council of Women. Mm-hmm. This was also read. I guess that was under Red Cross.
I'm fine, thank you.
Oh, I'll have a bit of date loaf if you can.
Oh, okay. All right.
Whether that was came through Red Cross or the university. I suspect that all of us who donated so much time, I don't know. We worked for Civil Defense in Burnaby, you see. My husband was, first he was the wardens, and then he was the gas officer for Burnaby.
What did that entail?
When they dropped the bomb with gas on it.
What was he supposed to do?
He had to do it. He had a great big of all plastic, I guess, gloves and hat, everything. And he got a phone call that said there'd been a bomb dropped. So he would dash away, and he had this big outfit. You could test what gas it was.
Oh, my.
All make-believe, of course, you see.
Yeah.
But it's not long ago we found that outfit in the attic and gave it to somebody, you see. So, now that was all under Civil Defense, you see. So whether the Red Cross... It was Red Cross under Civil Defense, you know, isn't that funny? You forget. I know his stuff was Warden's, was on Civil Defense. And I remember taking home nursing, that was under Civil Defense, you know. I don't know, because I got a button from the Red Cross, but I didn't know there was any of my stuff, because I didn't give them my stuff.
Yeah. Well, that was there, and there was also another certificate with your name on it from Simon Fraser University, 1964, I think it was.
Oh, well, when Simon Fraser was formed, anybody that was a university graduate were asked to be part of convocation, that's all.
Oh, that's what it was.
We thought we might go to things at Simon Fraser alone. Convocation wasn't very interesting, and it was. Did you ever go to Simon Fraser?
Oh, I've been out there and visited,
Their convocations in this great big expanse, and it was cold and windy, and you couldn't hear. So we only went once or twice. We still get all their newsletters from Simon Fraser. So I can't tell you whether it came from Burnaby or through the university. More likely university, but I didn't know there was any of that stuff. Now, where did we get off onto all that?
Well, we were talking about...
In the 40s, with the war effort, there were various committees formed. So, I don't recall, I suppose if I'd gone back through old notes, maybe I would have, but just from memory, I know we'd have reports and reading out, now maybe the thing that I have in my mind where they would read out these lists, maybe that was ones that we sent parcels to. But that must have been a separate committee, because ours would be called the Red Cross Committee, I think. So the Faculty Women's Club took over the Red Cross end of the war, of the university, you see. And the girls would just come in for 1 hour. Pajamas weren't bad, but trying to get one much out of them. The girls basted. I remember one girl, and we would let her work on pajamas without basting. And I ran into her in the Aggie building one day, and I said to my husband, "Who's that?" And he said, "Well, that's Mabel Robson, don't you know?" And I said, "Who's Mabel Robson?" "Well, oh, I knew who Mabel was. She was taking agriculture. She's one of the Robsons of Westminster. Her father was a millionaire." And we let her baste. We let her sew with them. And she was the only girl and several boys. And I said to Mrs. McLeod about this girl. And she said, "Oh, yes, she belongs to the same sorority as the McLeod girls." And she said, "She's very quiet, but she's quite a card, you know. She's always talking about the butler won't let her do something with the cook." And they all just said, "Oh, yes, you know." And it was true. They did. When she said the cook, she said, "I love to cook, but the cook won't let me." Nobody paid any attention to her. They didn't believe a word of it, you see. And this is when Bly said, "That's Mabel Robson. Her father's a millionaire." When after she got married and she made all her own curtains, and she loved to do that sort of stuff, you see. But not many of the girls were in that category. They had to baste. So that was the war. That was the only part. And I don't think we had... I can't remember of having many affairs.
What about after the war, when you had the influx of veterans onto the campus? Did that change the atmosphere a lot around the university?
It changed the Faculty Women's Club. Up till then, from the beginning of time, Mrs. Clark who was the first, one of the first members, you know, just died this spring, you know.
Yes.
We knew the club, but Robert phoned me up and told me the next day, his son. I don't know, where did I go? But they visited, and they, and see, there was early, the women, they were lifelong friends. They were the people when they came here. Mrs. Clark came as a bride. Mrs. Hutchison came as a bride. And they were young, so this kept on until once the veterans came back. Then at Fort Camp, this is before I was president. This is M.Y. Williams. M.Y. Williams is right. And Mrs. Sage was president. No, I think we called. Then next year, Mrs. M.Y. Williams. She was a chatterbox, and people didn't. She worried people. I don't know what it was. I knew her pretty well, and I remember saying to the executive, "Oh, give her to me. I know her. She's all right. I'll look after her." So she was a membership, and there were too many to call it, to start calling. The last year that I called on Mrs. Mann, Ken Mann's wife, Laura DeYoung, I have to think, oh, we called on Mrs. Chant. Mm-hmm. Now, most of these other girls, they were brides, and they were all of a dithy having the president of the faculty women's club call on them. They were quite nervous. And whoever was looking after arrangements would have arranged what time you were to come, you see. You could only do three in about an afternoon, you see. But now Nellie Chant was a little bit older, and when I guess it was Mrs. Williams, arranged, she said, well, our stuff hasn't come, but you come anyway. So we just sat on packing boxes. But that didn't worry Mrs. Chant. I mean, she, you know, she take it all in her stride.
What, did you come in to just to welcome her to the campus and to encourage her to join?
Oh, sure, they all joined in those early days.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, the Faculty Women's Club came and called on all the new wives. So from 1917 on, until in the 40s, this was, they called. Mm-hmm. So then when they went to the camp, the Fort Camp, and they arranged, I'd have to think, seven or eight that were there would meet in somebody's camp. Mm-hmm. And so we did it. I don't know what the... Where'd you get those things? I don't know what that is. Have
I? Oh, I'm fine.
Sure?
Yes.
I'll have to try them and see. That's funny. I never saw those before. We did it in groups. Then the next stage, we said we'll have one tea. And I think Mrs. Curtis, I think her was the same. The first one we went to where we had a tea and invited everybody at once, and of course from then on, that was what was followed. No. If we had a committee to help furnishing students' huts, I don't remember anything about it. It must have been a committee that was reporting. And I think we did stuff. I'm sure we started more bursaries to help them out. And of course, now there was a Dena Women's Fund. We must have started that about that time. You didn't run across that?
Well, I did. There was originally a faculty women's club bursary, and then it was felt that there were so many loans available through the university itself that the money would be more worthwhile being put into the Dean of Women's Fund. And it was about that time, or a tiny bit later, that started, I gather.
Yes, it would be. I think they still kept bursaries, though. Don't they still have one, huh?
I think so. I'm not sure. There's certainly still.
Oh well, they have.
So much help.
Well, they're so. They've Miss McKenzie, the thing from Margaret McKenzie, and
yeah.
And so everything works differently. So there isn't a dean of women, and even though I used to just go to. I didn't go to many night meetings, but I went. I haven't been to anything this year. I think I still paid fees. But then of latter years, I hadn't paid much attention to minutes. when Joyce Gardner was president, you mean at a run across? She got all involved in these picture business, and she said, "No, I want a motion to go through and be on their records." I don't remember how it was worded either, but there was something on the records of the Faculty Women's Club regarding the pictures, and that's not that. That was when Joyce was Gardner. Was a president, and then I remember seeing you second it, but I've forgotten what the details was, because then there had never been anything on our records regarding those doggone pictures, So they went ahead and assumed that they did belong to us,
Yeah.
Since they were given to the Mildred Brock Room, and the Mildred Brock Room was supposed to be for the Faculty Women's Club. Nothing in writing, though.
Right.
So, however Joyce's thing was worded, that there was something in the minutes regarding it. Then you see, the year that Vern James was away, I said, "I'm only a caretaker piece. And I'm just chairing this. I'm not initiating anything. I'm vice president and acting president." But I can't remember. See, the faculty women used to have a party. Now, I don't know when they started those parties that they sponsored for all the faculty. When they started.
This was the faculty club or the women's club?
Faculty women's club. Isn't that funny? I remember we used to get Gordon Shrum to be master of ceremonies because he yelled at everybody and if you had a reel and he was master of ceremonies and told people what to do. I don't know whether we had a dinner and parties, but oh yes, the Faculty Women's Club had parties. Isn't that funny? No, you didn't run across that.
Well, certainly Faculty Women's Club had parties from early on, like Christmas parties, an annual Christmas party, and of course luncheons and teas, but there were evening parties too, and sometimes there was a little theater piece or even music sometimes played. I saw one
minute. Oh, yes, that would be evening meetings, when the Faculty Women's Club had evening meetings, and they had sort of soirees, because they had a music, so on. Now, Kay Soward we'd have a chairman of I don't know what they called it, entertainment, but we'd have nights. Now a Christmas party. The Faculty Women's Club. I remember went to the North Shore. At Reston Park, we have Lynn.
And Lynn Valley?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Alex Renikoff, who was president of the early 50s, I think.
1952 to 1954. Is that right?
It'd be about
yeah.
in there.
Yeah. And then the next year you took over from Mrs. James.
That's right.
Yeah. So was Mrs. Renikoff a good president?
Oh yes. Do you know anything about her?
No, I don't.
Oh, well, I see. She comes out to see me. I phoned her. Alex Renikoff is Russian, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And her father was a policeman. And they were near the border when the revolution in 1917. And they just walked across the border. So they never were in any of the troubled mm-hmm. Russian part.
Mm-hmm.
And because Alex has no accent, no trace of accent. Alex has a very good mind. She speaks Russian. She taught Russian here. Oh yes, I would think. I guess it was when I was acting president that one year. They had never revised the Constitution from the early days,
mm-hmm.
and we had gotten sort of a. Oh, I know. They started having some part-time lectures, and in the early days, the part-time people didn't do anything. So we were in a bit of a jam, what we had to do. So Alex and I don't know who else, and Manolo Moe, we undertook to rewrite the Constitution, the bylaws. I don't know whether we changed the main part very much. But it was all on account of these parts. Now they don't make any difference. You read the calendar, you don't know who's who,
mm-hmm.
But we worked on that darn Constitution. For years they kept it intact. I remember how you did nominations. I remember writing that out, that the chairman had to be a retired member of the Faculty Women's Club. And somebody that has just retired, that would know the ropes. You see, you couldn't just take all outside people that didn't know the ropes. I think there were had to be four. And one was the past president, because they would have no interest in promoting it. So I mean, they kept this thing for years. It used to be funny, be sitting there reading something you'd written. But the Faculty Women's Club, yeah, they always had this party. I got off again. And the Renikoff, Alec Renikoff, I don't think you knew him. He was a brilliant Russian. But he got out of Russia. He was a graduate of a university, and he didn't come out till the 20s. Mm-hmm. And they must have been, I don't know just what you call these different, because he they should have been published. He wrote a lot of stories about his early day, and he would talk about what their coachman did, mm-hmm. and so on. So they obviously belonged to, not like the Volkovs. They August family belonged to one of the aristocracy groups, mm-hmm. not too high up, but still. Alec Renikoff certainly belonged to people that had money. But he left in the 20s. His mother gave him so much money, and he hitchhiked or walked his way across Russia and got out. Now, he always had a little bit of an accent, but he was a brilliant Russian. But we always laughed at him. When the second narrowest bridge went down, Alec was brought in as an engineer to try and discover what happened, but he couldn't get out here without getting lost. And he pretty well thought as quite a bit as a Russian. No, oh yes. But anyway, back at these parties, Alec didn't dance, and somebody in Marion and Murray, oh dear, in Slavonics for some reason. There was a group, we got together, and we used to meet at those parties and play Clue. Now, you may know Clue.
I love Clue.
Well, do you play it as an adult?
Yes.
Okay. Alec Renikoff, he was more fun. He just loved Clue. And of course, Harry Bell. Harry Bell, who's from engineering, has just retired. And he had a history of epilepsy, so he didn't dance. So anyway, this group, we used to go to the parties, but we would have a little room of our own and play Clue. And, that Clue business went on for quite a while. We'd go to the Christmas parties and play Clue. But Alec, you see, he would apply his mathematics, and he would say, you know, if you don't have that, well, the chances are 1-to-1 or 2-to-2 and all this sort of stuff, you see. And if you said you didn't have it and his mathematics was wrong, he'd look at you and he'd say, don't you, are you sure? You couldn't believe his mathematics was wrong, you know. So it was fun. He took it so seriously, he took his Clue so seriously. So we used to go to those parties. I don't know how long they kept them up. But the Faculty Women's Club would have, they had evening, they had business meetings, and they had, now I can't tell you how many we would have speakers, you know. We would have speakers at Morristown.
Yes, I saw that. You had faculty speakers, and also the women members of the clubs themselves. The club themselves used to speak if they took a trip or there's some issue that they felt was important. I saw there was a debate one time in 1956 on whether women were educating themselves to extinction. That was one of the debates. There were talks on trips and someone's trip in Russia and
That debate. Now they weren't all faculty women's club. It seems to me they had Sally Creighton.
Yes, that was, you've got a terrific memory.
Well, but you see, I know Sally, you see. It's only when you say that, you see. You see, that comes back, Sally.
And Mrs. Angus.
Mrs. Angus. Ann Angus, you see. Well, you see, I knew them. I knew Ann Angus's mother, you see.
Now, how did they do in the debate? Was there a...
Don't you
know? I wonder what
happened. Anne had a sister who wasn't very healthy. And the mother went... working during the summer, I used to go up picking fruit. Mind you, during the war, we made money picking fruit, you know. And her mother and brought this daughter up. And that's how I got to know her. So, and she had a science background. The mother had, she was quite a character. Mm-hmm. Old Mrs. Anderson. So, I knew Anne, yeah.
Just talking about the science background, I was very curious to know how you got into science. How did your interest start in that?
Oh, I liked it. I just liked it.
And you say your father was a school teacher?
He was good at math. He was good at math. I always was. I liked just go back to Sally Creighton a bit. I was in 21, Sally was in 23, and as a freshette, the first Mrs. Shrum, who was Noni Bailey. You ever got Noni Bailey?
No.
She had money. She was pretty. She was a female. The men would come in to a lab, and there'd been a party or something. They all discuss who took Noni Bailey out. So before I ever met Noni Bailey, I knew all about Noni Bailey as a freshette. She was one of these, you know. And when she married Gorton Shrum, it was a... Now this is my analysis, isn't anybody else's. This was a feather in her cap to marry a young professor. And this was a feather in his cap to marry. this freshette. Okay. Sally Creighton. I must tell you about Sally Creighton. She was Irish. She had a very quick wit. The men were scared to death of Sally. They were afraid to have too much to do it with her. Well, they liked her, but this clever wit, they never knew when they were going to get exposed, and they'd be the worst of the bargain. And